This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Open for business on BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Roshan Kanesan, and welcome to Open for Business, the show that dives into the journeys and ventures of entrepreneurs and business leaders. And this morning on the show, we've got Jen Low, founder and CEO of Malaysian jewelry brand Wanderlust & Co. Jen's Wanderlust journey began back in 2010 in her apartment in Melbourne. And ladies and gentlemen, that was pre-Instagram, just to give you a bit of context. She saw a gap in the market for a lack of digital jewelry brands that had trendy designs but were also affordable. And powered by a WordPress website, self-made graphic designs, and about 10,000 ringgit in startup money, she decided to tackle that gap. Today, Wanderlust is present in nearly 30 countries, making over 70% of its revenue outside of Malaysia. It's been worn by the likes of Kendall Jenner and Selena Gomez as well. Beyond that, Wanderlust has made the move into physical retail. It now has three physical outlets in Malaysia, and in 2023, took the physical leap abroad with their first ever physical store outside of Malaysia in Singapore. I think they have two there now. Today on Open for Business, we're going to dive into the 14-year journey that Jen has been on building Wanderlust, how she built the business and how it started, and of course, what her vision for the company looks like ahead. Jen, welcome to the show.
Super excited to be here.
Yeah, super excited. But the weather looking a bit dreary outside. Hopefully we can change the dynamic here in the studio. So an interesting journey you've been on, Jen, because your background, you know, you were studying accounting when you were in Monash, if I'm not mistaken. And back when you were in Melbourne, you were already working. You saw this gap in the market for on-trend designs that were affordable, basically. Could you take us back to 2010 and elaborate further on that decision to start Wanderlust? What brought you into this business?
So thank you so much, first of all, for having me here. Definitely, we're going to bring the sunshine on this great KL day. I would love to share that what truly sparked me at that point was very much the lifestyle retail landscape in Australia. Mm-hmm. I noticed that, of course, we all know retail is a business and it is obviously to drive profit, you know, and turn revenue. But I noticed that there was a big storytelling movement. There was a big movement of purpose in terms of the mission of why brands exist. And so retail isn't just, you know, to buy and sell something because the consumer wants A and they're willing to pay B for A, but it was a lot to do with why would I want to wear this brand? Why does this brand mean something? What does it stand for? And how does it make me feel when I wear it?
Yeah. So that was what you were observing in terms of this jewelry space there. When you started Wanderlust, talk to us about, because you were doing it as a side hustle initially, right? What were you doing as you were starting this business?
Yeah, so I actually studied a bit of a backstory here. So I actually studied accounting because my Asian dad was very, very, very adamant that is what you do. You go to university, you either become a doctor, a lawyer, or an accountant. So
I'm sure very relatable to a lot of the Asians out there.
I think so. A lot of scarred children, a lot of scarred millennials. So I negotiated with him and I did two degrees at the same time for one extra year only. Mm-hmm. I overloaded three semesters and two summer schools, and I ended up graduating also with a Bachelor in Business Accounting, mm-hmm. tick, thank you, Dad, and Bachelor of Arts majoring in Communications in Psychology. And I think during that time, I wanted to figure out for myself, am I going to pursue accounting or am I going to go much more into the arts? Mm-hmm. And so I did an internship at Deloitte in auditing the universe blessed auditors, but I realized it wasn't entirely for me. It didn't speak to my soul. And so I took part-time jobs when I was at university, working the cafe floor, working the retail floor. And there was a store particularly that I worked in where my ex-boss at that time stocked more than 100 Australian independent brands across accessories, which includes jewelry, handbags, watches. And that really piqued my interest. The ability to, you know, create something, have it stand for something, and customers in Australia really being so brand proud that, oh, this is Australian started, this is Australian founded, and it's made in Australia. So I learned so much from the shop floor, from tasks as mundane as to wiping down shelves, all the way up to how to upsell And eventually, when I graduated, I ended up working in retail and fashion full time as a buyer and also the store manager. And then eventually at head office to do the merchandising and the assortment planning. And from there, I realized that, hey, there's no Asian-based or founded brand that does this, that creates clean jewelry, sustainable jewelry that has a story to tell, unique designs that's not what you would expect from a fast fashion brand, and to be really proud, to be proud to be Asian-based and made by women for women.
Yeah, I really like this theme, and I've found myself over the last few years kind of trying to do my best to buy Malaysian first, all these different brands from actually just last week bought something from Wanderlust for the first time. I think preparing for this interview kind of incepted me, and I was very pleased with the experience overall. But Jen, taking us back to the early days, when did it stop? Because you were working at the time, 3.5 years you were working. When did Wanderlust stop becoming a side hustle and it became your full-time venture?
So I actually parked the domain name Wanderlust & Co. for a year before I did anything, before I worked up the courage to even do anything. And the word Wanderlust means to continuously seek. Mm-hmm. It used to refer only to travel, right? But I felt that the digital women and digital people today are very nomadic. And looking back now, I think I definitely had that foresight because travel is such a big thing now. We're constantly seeking to learn new things. Mm-hmm. So that's where the name came from. And I started building the website on WordPress. Thank you for doing the research on that. I'm very impressed with you.
As a fellow WordPress user back in the early 2010s, I relate to that.
Right. Everything was modular. You could pick drag and drop from the back end. So I built the site on the back end with one freelancer with 10,000 ringgit and bought all the stocks. And then it started to take off. When people started transacting on the website who weren't names that I knew, I felt like there was something there. And a little, you know, nugget of wisdom for anyone that is listening in. As an entrepreneur, if you're starting something new and you're trying to figure things out, there will be a moment when your friends will all support you, your family will support you, but there's only so much business you can get and sustain with friends and family supporting you. Yeah. When you start seeing an upstream of strangers buying the product because they don't owe you anything to need to purchase, that's when you know you've got something gold on your hands, and that will be a pivotal moment you must celebrate. So a bit of personal story here. My now husband, then boyfriend, is actually Australian, but living and working in Malaysia and Singapore. So here I am, a Malaysian, living and working in Australia, and there he is, an Australian, living and working in Malaysia. And it was him, you know, a personal reason. He mapped out a whole roadmap for me as to why Wanderlust would flourish if I moved back to Malaysia. Mm-hmm. Of course, he had a big personal motivation.
I'm sure. Some slight bias in the mapping, I'm sure, but
right.
It's played out 14 years later.
I know. We now have two kids, so phew, it worked out.
What gave you, the road mapping obviously must have provided you some kind of, at least, okay, this is the way forward, you know, if I come back to Malaysia. But you came back to Malaysia about a year into the business, if I have that correct.
Yes.
And you essentially had to kind of restart because you had to build a new team, you have to redo the supply chain as well. Talk to us about that experience of having to restart over here. I mean, it was 1 year into the business, so hopefully there wasn't too much to restart. But what was that like coming back here, rebuilding the business?
Honestly, it was a bit of a culture shock and readjustment, which seems strange because I spent close to 10 years in Australia. And the Australian way of working and the culture of just how you perceive and perspect about information situations is quite different. Mm. Malaysia has changed so much. So I'm so proud today of the landscape of business and entrepreneurism in Malaysia as well. But back then, again, this was, you know, 2011. I think the big thing for me when it comes to hiring and building a team or solving any business problem is always, always go back to the basics. Mm. sometimes we have, as humans, an amazing ability to complicate everything. Things can be as complicated or as simple as you would like it to be. So to me, whenever you're stuck, go back to your five questions: who, what, when, why, how. And so I would always go back to who should I hire? What am I trying to achieve? And solve things one step at a time.
How long did it take you to get the business back to where it was before you left Australia?
To be honest, I think that moving back was a bigger personal adjustment. Okay. From a business perspective, it was more cost effective to ship from here, logistics, storage, manpower in terms of pick packing orders. E-commerce was still in its infancy. So I had a lot of fresh graduates who were very interested and excited to work for a brand that relocated from Australia back to, you know, Malaysia. So talent pool and affordability was definitely one of the plus points. And I would say, you know, if you're thinking about scaling a global business from Malaysia, I would say it still remains to be one of the key points.
You gave up your career. I mean, let's not even talk about accounting. That didn't really take
fashion
off.
Fashion career.
So your fashion career, your 9 to 5, basically. 3.5 years in, decided that, you know, I'm going to build my own brand here. Now, the truth of the matter is that most businesses, new businesses, fail or, you know, remain side hustles forever. What gave you the confidence to put aside a 9 to 5 job and embark on this full time? I mean, hindsight's 2020. We know 14 years later, it's panned out well. But
yes.
At that time, what gave you that confidence? Or what was the mental model that you were using when you made that decision?
Honestly, I think for me, and to this day, it still remains the same. Whenever I make a decision, it's 50% data, 50% intuition. And you speak to a lot of entrepreneurs, you'll know that a lot of us are very guided by intuition. I recently went to Oxford to do a short course in strategic leadership. And interestingly, even Oxford is now looking into how our emotions and past experiences are actually a form of data. Mm. So to me, I was guided 50% by data, meaning the profitability of the business, the growth of the business, and another 50% intuition of me feeling like, look, this is the right thing to do.
Was there a particular moment when you realized that, okay, this is no longer a side hustle? Was it when you crossed a certain amount of revenue, a certain number of customers? Because you gave us a sense earlier for there were other people buying my products, not just family and friends. Was that the moment, or was there a number that came with it as well?
That's a very good question. So there was one particular moment. So I don't know if you follow the blogging scene at that time, very far removed from your realm of interest, I'm sure, fashion blogging, female scene. But there were a few key bloggers like Omi Song, Chriselle Lim, Leandra Medine, who ran a blog called The Man Repeller. And all these people are actually featured in, you know, Time Out New York, in InStyle magazine, that I personally just reached out to. And I said, hey, you know, I'm an Asian-based brand. This is what I'm championing. I would love to send you some product. So gifting influencers today is very, very common. And it's definitely now at least 25% of anyone's marketing budget, if not more. But back then it was unheard of. Why are you sending strangers your product for free? You have to spend shipping. You know, you have to give them free product. Like, what is this for?
And still pre-Instagram at this point?
This was at the start of Instagram. Yeah. So, and then I noticed that these very, very talented content creators, as they are known for now, who have access to so many global brands and so many big names, were very excited by the designs of Wonderlust and the story and the brand that we are. And at that point, they started wearing it, they started tagging, and quite a lot of products went into pre-order and sold out. And I had my grandma, the queue scene, it was 9 p.m. at night. My grandma was sitting in one corner. It was after family dinner time on a Sunday. My grandma was folding Wonderlust boxes, because back then I was trying to save money. I didn't have ready prepared boxes. I had, you know, boxes you had to fold because they were flat pack boxes. Another no-no, guys. Just buy packaging that's pre-made. But at that point, I was looking around the room. My cousins were folding boxes. I had this production line set up in my dining room. And my grandma was folding boxes, and I was like, I think I need to do this full time. So that was basically it.
Jen, we got more to get into, but first we got to go into a few messages. Folks, I've been speaking with Jen Lo, founder and CEO of Malaysian jewelry brand Wonderlust & Co. I'm Roshan Kanasin. You're listening to Open for Business. We'll be back in just a bit. So keep it here to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Before Friday materializes, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9. I'm Roshan Kunnison and welcome back to Open for Business. And this morning, I'm speaking with Jen Low, founder and CEO of Malaysian jewellery brand Wanderlust & Co. Jen, earlier you gave us a sense for the initial start of this and you realised that you wanted to take this full-time, or it was time to take it full-time, when your entire family was sitting in the hall folding boxes because you had sold out your jewellery at the time. When you were starting this out, were the products, you know, were you reselling other products? Were you designing them in-house? What did it look like from a design, from a product development perspective early on, all these products that you were selling out before you went full-time?
Yeah, so when I first started, I had to pick very artisanal jewelry producers. I think first off, what was always very important to me is a focus on clean jewelry and making things the right way. Mm. And so when we first started out, I was working a lot more with single producers who are really like doing everything from scratch, all steps of the jewelry making by themselves. And then today, we work actually with BSCI Certified Production Partners, a lot of fancy words. It's a UK accreditation, which basically means that before jewelry is in metal form, it's actually in liquid form. Mm. And we filter out zinc, lead, cadmium alloy, which are actually allergens for your skin. So one very interesting fun fact, most Western jewelry brands are formulated in cold climate. If you think about it, a lot of European, American, whether it's easily 6 to 8 months of the year is cold.
Yeah.
Whereas, of course, we know in Asia, it's super, super humid. It's
not cold.
Not cold at all. And if you put a pile of jewelry that's lower quality or has these allergen metals in it, it tends to rust and smells like wet metal, which essentially is the kind of stuff like iron, lead that you put into making a gate that ends up rusting. So today, there is a huge emphasis for me on not just making things look good, but women who are so busy, people who are so busy, need to be able to wear this product and feel comfortable running around all day. If it can work in our climate, when we're sweating through our day, especially recently, the heat wave, it can work in any climate.
And what was the biggest challenge when you were building this in the early days? Let's say the first 5 years.
Yeah. I always believe that we are our own mountains.
Mm.
Your biggest challenge is yourself. And I don't mean that in a very abstract way. I hope it's not coming across abstract, but I think humans are amazing. I think Malaysians, especially Malaysian entrepreneurs, they are amazing. We will find the answer to anything. It all boils back down to your desire and your resilience. So first of all, we need to get out of our own limiting beliefs, clarify the problem, break it down into little steps, gather your tribe and your people who believe in the mission, delegate, rally your team, motivate them. I am only as good as my team.
Mm.
I spend a lot of time with my team motivating them, unpacking the reason why we're doing this. What's our mission? What are our values? I always say to my team when they are faced with a challenge, if a customer spends $5, give them $10 in value.
Mm.
So if you didn't deliver that, then go back to the drawing board. What are we changing? So honestly, in the first 5 years versus today, my challenges are the same. I need to get over my own mountain, which is my limiting belief. Because if I don't believe in the problem and how to solve it, how do I get everybody else to buy the product or do the work we need to grow the business?
Given your importance, the importance you put on team, right? That, you know, you're only as good as the team that you are leading. What are some aspects of talent management that have worked for you? Because talent acquisition is one issue. Talent retention is another. Two big struggles for a lot of entrepreneurs out there. What has worked for you in getting and keeping people?
Again, a very good question. I think there's no absolute magic formula. And I do believe in the synergy of energy, meaning that sometimes a candidate or a talent might look perfect on paper and then you start and it's just chaos. So seriously, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it has a lot to do with intentionality. Mm. In most of my interviews, one of my key questions I always ask is, what do you want to achieve for yourself? Mm. Forget impressing me in this interview. Tell me what you want from your career. Because my job is to make sure what you want for yourself aligns with what I need from this role. Then we have sync and synergy. And then we can start talking about the work. Otherwise, without alignment and synergy, and it's just chaos.
Mm.
Nothing gets done.
Do you, you know, the product is the centerpiece in all this, right?
Of course.
And when you started, you were selling from independent jewelry makers. Do you remember your first sale?
Yes.
I know this was 14 years ago.
It was a carousel ring. It was a ring designed to look like a carousel. So the brand started out very, very whimsical. And I think also we are very, very much in tune with trends of mm-hmm. the world. So dreaminess at the start of Instagram, if you remember all those very lo-fi filters with little bubbles and sparkles and yeah. all that sort of stuff. And now we've come a long way in terms of visuals and trend visuals. So that very first sale was a carousel ring. And to this day, I think what I distilled from that very first sale and that first collection was called Into the Woods, where we were gathering objects in a forest to turn into jewelry. But what we still do to this day and hold true is, how do we make fashion fun? How do we ignite? And you see this trend on TikTok called girl math or girlhood. How do we all get so trapped and lost in our thoughts and being serious. How do we have fun?
Mm.
Because a lot of magic comes when you have fun, including growing a business and making money and looking good and feeling good whilst you're doing all of that.
From that first sale to today, been about 14 years now or more or less. Talk to us about how the business has evolved over the last 14 years. Yes, you came back to Malaysia, you started going, building your, or contracting your own products, making your own products. What were some of the key changes that you've had to make in the business over the last 14 years?
It's changed so much. If I had to boil it down to a few things, I would say, first of all, systems.
Mm-hmm.
Systems are super important. If you're an entrepreneur with a medium-sized business, take the time to invest in your back end. When you have more team members join, people want clarity.
Mm.
I think the job of a CEO is to set someone up for success. Of course, if you have someone with an attitude and performance issue, that's slightly separate. But if you have great eggs on your team, I always see it as my job to also help my team develop themselves. So systems is very important. The second thing for me is, I would say, definitely data. Over 14 years, we have learned so much about who the Wanderlust customer is, where is he or she based, you know, and price points, categories across necklaces, earrings, rings, wristwear, sizes of rings and wristwear, like all of this very unsexy stuff, the data is super, super important.
Jen, we've got a lot more to get into, including where the business is today in terms of revenue, what growth looks like looking ahead, and also how the business got 70% of its revenue from foreign markets. Folks, I've been speaking with Jen Loh. She's the founder and CEO of Malaysian jewellery brand Wanderlust & Co. And you've been listening to Open for Business. I'm Roshan Kanasen. We'll be back in just a bit. So keep it here to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Best for money. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Roshan Kanasen and welcome back to Open for Business. This morning, I'm speaking with Jen Loh, founder and CEO of Malaysian jewellery brand Wanderlust & Co., a brand that she started 14 years ago while she was in Melbourne and started with a gap in the market for affordable jewellery brands that were on trend, that were homemade, inspired by what she was seeing over in Australia. Today, 14 years later, 70% of the business is outside of Malaysia and Singapore, and she's got three physical stores right now, with two in Malaysia, two in Singapore. Jen, 14-year journey, it's been really interesting listening to all of it. And how it started, right? Yes, you had an accounting degree, you did a double degree in communications as well, didn't use the accounting degree, went into fashion, built this company a few years later. How have you funded all this, right? Because, you know, we're so used to, in this day and age of particularly D2C e-commerce businesses, raising funds and, you know, growing and all of that, all this VC funding. How have you funded your business?
So I have a slightly different view when it comes to VC funding and its relationship with retail as an industry. So if you take a look at the global landscape, right, at classic D2C success stories that have recently not done so well, take Glossier, for example, right? I personally don't think, or Stitch Fix, for example,
yeah.
right? I personally don't think that fashion retail is a Silicon Valley story. I think fashion retail is a traditional business model. So what VCs do is they come in from Silicon Valley and they impose all this like EBITDA, 10X, 20X, like all this stuff, you know, they throw a lot of money into the business expecting it to scale like a digital business, like it's Bitcoin, but it's not. What you are doing essentially as a fashion brand is you are creating a product. You're offering value, you're telling customers why you're different from your competitors, and you're asking them to either go online to punch in their credit card details in exchange for that product or walk into a store again to hand over their payment method and walk away with the product. That to me is essentially traditional business model. Mm. It's not a Silicon Valley model.
So even though you've gone the e-commerce route, you still see it as the not the old way of doing business, but a more traditional model.
It is a traditional model. Mm. So, you know, like sometimes I like to simplify things into analogies. So, you know, if I guess if you're a duck, you're a duck. You know, you're not a chicken. Mm-hmm. So first of all, you need to identify what are you?
Yeah.
How can you even scale if you don't understand yourself and the type of business you actually are? So on that very basis, to me, VC funding has never been so sexy, because I also understand that when people give you their money, and rightly so, it comes with a host of expectations. You also give up control. And ultimately, you know, sometimes that is something you do if you need to bring in more intellect, more strategic capability into the business. But also there are agencies you can work with, right? So for example, when it comes to PR, I can always contract with an agency for a period to understand a little bit more. When it comes to, you know, event management, I can work with an event company, and the list goes on. There are a lot of very talented businesses out there that would provide services for a retail business who wants to scale.
So how have you funded the business? Has it been, I mean, aside from the first 10,000 ringgit, has it been mostly from internally generated funds?
Yes. So I started from the 10,000 ringgit, and stubbornly so, perhaps because of my very traditional upbringing, I have...
Maybe it was the accounting as well.
I think so. Through all the C's and D's in my accounting degree, all A's, straight A's in the arts degrees. I think I very, very stubbornly wanted to be very independent. So to this day, like, we roll the profits of the business into its next phase. And I have to share a story which I, you know, hope listeners can take something away from. There are years, especially with economic downturn, where we don't make a profit, right? Mm-hmm. But my dad, who is a businessman himself, once gave me this very simple analogy. He goes, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. So when you lose in that year in terms of profit, you ask yourself, what assets and brand growth have you leveraged? And then you take a 2-year view on your P&L rather than a 1-year view. So if this year you don't profit to what you've expected, then you've got next year ahead of you uncharted. So you change your strategy there, and then you think, what will make you happy, or what would make the strategy pan out the way that it would satisfy the needs of the business across a 2-year period? So to me, creating a brand is not a sprint. It is absolutely a marathon, which is again why the VC method might not always work. VCs take a sprint method. When you build traditionally, you take a marathon. It's like raising a child. You start and it doesn't end. You keep going and you enjoy that process. You don't hate the process. You learn from it. The journey itself teaches you something, and so on and forth.
Now let's get a sense for the product mix and the market positioning today, right? What is the Wanderlust customer look like? What is the target market today?
So the target market is something that continues to surprise my team and I. So we obviously started geared to millennials at that point, you know, in 2010.
Wanderlust, the name itself is very millennial. So yeah, I can imagine that.
Right. And today we actually have opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of our customers. A lot of tweens actually go into our stores to buy things because they see us on TikTok, they see us on Instagram. And interestingly also, I think that younger Gen Zs are a bit more conscious about their spend. They will be happy with, you know, 2 to 3 Wanderlust pieces that they wear all the time instead of 30 pieces from a fast fashion jewelry brand, but it doesn't last at all and it rusts and it tarnishes and it changes the color of their fingers. We also have grandmas and older elderly women shop in our stores. So women in their 50s, in their 60s. And that gives me so much joy because we've now evolved past just being by women for women, but it's now by people for the community. Mm-hmm. And on any given day when we have an event in store or an activation in store, or there's a key festive season and the stores are packed, sometimes customers will make friends on the floor and volunteer and help each other put products on. And you will see someone older speaking to someone younger and giving her advice. And that to me gives me so much more joy sometimes than a positive, you know, number on a P&L. Like, that's very important. But all I'm saying is that as an entrepreneur, like, never forget why you're doing what you're doing.
Now, you mentioned TikTok. Now, you started this business pre-Instagram, right? Today, not only do we have Instagram and Pinterest, we have TikTok, which has changed the game in terms of how social media is utilized, right? It's no longer about social networks. It's about algorithmic content being driven to all sorts of a much wider audience, right?
Yeah.
Talk to us about how, when Instagram came in, how did it change the business then?
Yeah.
And how different is it now that TikTok is in the game?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. It's a lot to navigate. Feels sometimes like every time you turn around, there's a new app because there was Lemonade for a while.
Yes.
Right? And you know, the list goes on. For me, Instagram changed the game because it provided a platform for any brand, no matter where you are in the world, so long as you are creating something of quality and your brand has a particular authentic aesthetic, mm-hmm. that stands out and speaks out to your target audience, you can make it. So I think that was what was pivotal in terms of Instagram, I think. And I would say because we were such an early adopter of Instagram, we were literally there, you know, when it first started and very active. And before KOL budget was a thing, you know, I really saw the, now there's a term, influencer marketing. There was no term back then.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw a lot of talented people who were so good at styling things and then wanted their take on how would they style our pieces. So I think that was pivotal. Now, to the second part of your question about TikTok. TikTok is a lot about virality. Whilst it's very, very important to tap into something, of course, it's amazing that you can go from, I guess, 2,000 views to 20 million views. But at the end of the day, one thing that I always hold close to heart is when you're asking people to part with their hard-earned money, they'll buy with you one time for virality, but they will buy with you forever if you deliver value.
That is a wonderful point to make, actually, because virality, if you don't have that follow through in terms of the quality of the product, then it's just a one-time purchase.
Then it's
don't
a fad.
There's no lifetime value to that long-term value to that customer, right?
Yeah.
So that's how social media has played out. You talked about a little bit about influencer marketing. Now, when I was reading about Wanderlust and your journey, a few names popped up in terms of people who've won it, including Gigi Hadid, Selena Gomez, and Kendall Jenner. How did this happen? Was it part of a marketing strategy? Was it organic? Tell us a little bit about this.
Honestly, it was at that time where the whole girl gang movement first started. Mm-hmm. And I would say the digital feminism as we know it today, that was again at that 10 years ago was when the start of, you know, this topic of female empowerment, equality, gender equality and all that. My logic was, again, 50% work, 50% personal.
Mm-hmm.
50% work being, how cool would that be? What amazing, awesome brand value to be seen on these talented, amazing women. But the other 50% was, I just appreciated what these women stood for.
Mm-hmm.
So the way we actually got our products seen on them was via their stylists. So at that time, and now you see huge communities of like makeup artists, hairstylists, stylists themselves, editors, mm-hmm. writers, you know, content creators who were working for the traditional media, right? Starting their personal accounts on Instagram, sharing their view of what this all means. And for me, Instagram is a place back then when it first started where you meet and connect with other like-minded, talented individuals. It was a gathering of like-minded individuals. So I just again reached out to these people and said, hey, I just love your work. I read your article. You wrote about this. That really resonated. Can I send you some pieces? And then they would receive the pieces to say, hey, I've got a shoot next week for, you know, Maybelline. I've got Gigi Hadid, I've got Kendall, then I'll just send them a ton of product and say, yeah, sure, you know, like, here you go. And there's never a guarantee. But next thing I know, Gigi Hadid's walking the Nickelodeon show for the Kids' Choice Awards back then because she started so young.
Yeah.
And she was fully in Wonderlust. Next thing, boom, she was at Coachella. She was fully decked in Wonderlust. ASOS, which was one of the first high fast fashion online brands in the UK, London at that time, a hub of fashion in the world, picked up that picture where Gigi tagged Wonderlust and reposted it because they were doing a media feature on best jewelry stacks at Coachella. And the list goes on and on because then Eva Chen, who was back then editor at Lucky Magazine, still at Condé Nast, was like, wait, these cool girls and cool kids are wearing this. I'm going to now talk about Wonderlust and this up and coming Asia based brand, because at that time, media in New York was in love with brands outside of the US who were doing something interesting. So I think it goes back to me to authenticity and, you know, being resilient and saying, being authentic to why are you doing this? What are you hoping to achieve? Communicating that clearly and then not giving up.
Jen, more to get into, particularly the business side of things, which we'll get into in a few minutes. Folks, I've been speaking with Jen Low, founder and CEO of Malaysian jewelry brand Wonderlust & Co. I'm Roshan Kanisan. You're listening to Open for Business. We'll be back in just a bit, so keep it here to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Because friends matter. BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to Open for Business. I'm Roshan Kanisan, and this morning I'm speaking with Jen Low, founder and CEO of Malaysian jewellery brand Wonderlust & Co. Jen, we've been talking about the 14-year journey and some of the key moments that have made this business what it is today, some of them including the time when you and your family were sitting around in the hall packing your product, and when you realised that this is something that I could go into full time. There was also when you were approaching stylists to get your product to them. So it ended up on celebrities such as Gigi Hadid and Selena Gomez. Back when that opportunity obviously was still present, I'm sure that arbitrage is no longer organic, at least. 14 years in, can you tell us a little bit about where the company is in terms of revenue today?
So we have, we hit our seven-figure mark, I would say halfway into the journey. Mm-hmm. And today we're beyond that. We are self-funded. We are profitable. And one of my key goals in terms of profitability is to always, when I do my budget, I always set aside at least 5 to 10% to grow the business, to give bonuses and increments back to my team, to take them on trips and experiences, to treat them. So for me, my budget is always split out into a percentage of profit that I need and then a percentage that I continue to invest back into my team and the business and its growth.
That's a very smart way of going about it, right? It's like when companies issue have profits, you can either deploy it back into the business, you can issue dividends. You're taking that view here where you have a little bit of a ratio in terms of, I'll take this for the business, this, let's reinvest it in the business. Do you have a growth? So you, seven figures, about halfway in. Have you hit the eight-figure mark yet?
We are very close.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in terms of growth this year, what are you expecting there?
For us, we have embarked on our omni-channel journey in the last 3 years. So very interesting story. I like that you brought up that you went to visit our Bangsa Village store, the BV location. So I'm going to share a personal story. So my landlord at Bangsa Village reached out to me in 2019 and he offered me a lot on the ground floor next to Coffee Bean, which is the store you went to. I turned him down 3 times. I said, no, Vincent.
Really?
Yep. I said, I'm not doing offline. I will never sleep. I said, you don't understand. I'm the type of person who will give my 110%. And he was like, no, Jen, it's easy. You know, like, why only online? Like, you're completely missing out. You are already such a community-driven founder. You're going to love it. And in the end, he offered me such an unbeatable deal where he would just take a percentage and there was no rent.
Wow.
He said, that's how much I believe in the brand. Please don't, anyone listening, pillage Bangsa Village for this. But to this day, I am so, so grateful for that opportunity because we had a three-month pop-up. We had a figure that we anticipated for revenue for 3 months. We hit that target in 2 weeks.
Wow.
Yep. And then I started being so addicted to the store. I was essentially the store manager. Mm. Instead of going into the office every day, I went to the shop and I started talking to everyone.
It's such a real life experience, right? Because when you're doing e-commerce, it's digital, and yes, you get feedback and comments.
Yeah.
But when you're at a physical location,
yeah,
you can talk to the customers. It's such a visceral, real life experience.
That yeah.
The real feedback in real time.
For sure. And I don't know if you read this article in the last 6 months. Starbucks got a new CEO.
Yes.
And he went onto the Starbucks drive-thru and he just manned the drive-thru. Like, I'm that CEO.
Mm.
I'm like, don't give me a desk. Put me on the floor. Let me talk to the people who are paying for this product. Please let them tell us what they think is the worst part of the product and the best part of the product, the experience, the whole shebang. And then let's go back to the drawing board and do something with that. Let's bring joy to our customers.
In terms of the offline to online story, how much of, I'm presuming most of the business is still e-commerce and online. What's the ratio there in terms of the revenue split?
So in terms of D2C, we have Wanderlust & Co. branded D2C, which is wanderlust&co.com and then our five stores. In terms of B2B, we also sell to department stores. For example, one of our very loyal stock is John Lewis in London. They have 17 offline locations. We're in seven of their top doors, which includes like Oxford Street in London, Manchester. So that's great as well, the B2B part. And then we have dropship platforms, which is like FBA, Amazon, which if anyone's tuning in, I fully recommend looking into Amazon, looking into Fulfilled by Amazon, where it's a concept called cross-docking. So on consignment, you would ship them product, they store it at their warehouse, and you man the whole online platform yourself from the back end, like a shop-in-shop on that platform, like Lazada, like Shopee, right? And then they drop ship the product from their warehouse for you. So we have all these different models, some of which eventuated during the time of COVID. Prior to COVID, we were focused very much only on wanderlust&co.com on and offline locations, but then COVID forced us more onto these platforms. And I would say all in, I'm very grateful to have this portfolio of sales points because the Shopee customer might not necessarily be the Amazon customer, and the .com customer or the TRX retail customer might not necessarily be the Lazada customer.
Yeah.
So really as a brand, your job is to put yourself as much out there, because even if you're not transacting and hitting your targets on those platforms, it serves as a point of positioning and I would say advertising.
Now, your business, a lot of it is outside Malaysia and Singapore, right? 70% of it. And this is something similar I saw with RPG Commerce, Melvin Chi, who they run
Montego,
Bottoms Lab, all these different brands. How did your business become so largely outside the country?
I think, first of all, goals. For me, Malaysia is our home base. But really, the product is for every digital person when we first started. And then today, of course, for the community overall. So first, you need to start with your goals. And this doesn't work for everyone and everything. You know, if you're selling food product that expires, of course, this is not possible, right? Or if you're selling something that's very indigenous to the culture locally, then again, not so possible. But when I first started out with the category, what really drew me to jewelry, its size inclusivity, no matter what race or, you know, for that matter, religion you are. I think people everywhere around the world appreciate jewelry. So for me, it goes back to the goal. What is your goal? Because it sounds great to say you're a global business and 70% of your sales is outside of Malaysia and Singapore, which is this little region we're in, but does it fit and suit your business? For me, for jewelry, it suits because it's small, it's light to ship, because you might be selling a product that's very, very heavy to ship and your freight costs and your handling charges might not be profitable for you to make it a global brand. Then you're better off pricing down, having slightly less margin, but spending very little of your overheads on shipping, you know. A large proportion of my overheads is actually shipping, because we do 2-day global shipping, full stop. Yeah. So our margins do go to shipping, but because the product is small and light, then it enables that. So I don't believe in a copy and paste. I think as a founder and as an entrepreneur, you need to create clarity around what can be achieved and what are you trying to achieve.
Jen, with the 1 minute or so that we have remaining here, talk to us about what you see as the next stage for Wanderlust.
So many things, but mostly I am actually in a regrounding phase of our business where we're going back to the basics. We're telling the story of what the products are made of. I'm super, super excited that next week we're launching a campaign called House of Icons. And essentially what we've done is we've looked into the 14-year archive, we've pulled out the best-selling motifs, and we are now, you might find this interesting, creating, spawn products, sister products of these pieces to be worn across all genders. Gender fluidity and neutrality is something I think all brands should go for. We should value people, not just, I think that the feminism was a great last decade narrative, but here on forth, let's talk about people regardless of skin color. One more fun fact, our 14K gold is a champagne tone. We formulate this specific tone out of 35 different gold swatches so that this tone of gold looks great on all skin tones. So that to me is the future. Embracing all genders, embracing all people as a community in terms of our brand growth.
And given that you haven't raised any VC money, you've funded this yourself, do you see yourself running this indefinitely, or do you have ambitions for an IPO or something like that?
People ask me all the time, like, if I have an exit plan, and I honestly don't. I don't. And if I ever were to exit the business, it would be for a very specific reason where a partner comes in to really scale this further. Like if they go, well, we can make Wanderlust and Kojo Malone, you can now be in 200 countries, every country to exist on the face of the planet, then I'll think about it. But for now, I just really am enjoying this journey.
Jen, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Folks, I've been speaking with Jen Loh, founder and CEO of Malaysian jewellery brand Wanderlust & Co. And if you missed any part of this conversation, you can catch the podcast on the BFM app or on BFM.my or wherever you listen to podcasts. Just look for Open for Business. I'm Roshan Kanasan. This is BFM 89.9, the business station.
You've been listening to Open for Business on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.